Welcome back to Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, the theme of tonight's show is Talk the Talk, which is perfect for my next guest. Lori Gottlieb is a therapist. She does the Dear Therapist advice column for The Atlantic. She writes for several publications. She's a New York Times bestseller. But for this story, for this interview, Lori went from therapist to patient. After a breakup, Lori recognized she needed someone to talk to, so she signed up to talk with Wendell. And what she learned about her breakup, her relationship, and her outlook changed her life forever. The book is called Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, a therapist, her therapist, and our lives revealed. It's a heartfelt look at therapy and how therapists approach their craft and struggle with getting out of their own way, just like the rest of us. Lori Gottlieb in studio. Lori, thanks for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me.
There's something really great about this being part memoir and part clinical guide to understanding how therapy works. Why do it that way? Why tell your story through also giving some of the trade secrets of how you operate and work?
Well, I really wanted to demystify what therapy is, so I didn't want us to have trade secrets. I didn't want to be the wizards. I think that keeps a lot of people from getting help because they have a lot of misconceptions about what therapy is. It's really this very rich human experience. And I wanted to bring in people to the therapy room so they could see for themselves through the stories of my patients. So we follow four main patients throughout the book who are very different from one another. And then I'm the fifth patient because I'm going to therapy as well.
There's two parts to this. There's the one of you as a therapist really engaging and trying to let yourself go to be a patient. But the other part of this too is you as a therapist learning how to interact with your patients or grow with your patients. Which do you gravitate more to in this story?
I think both. I think they're both different, and they're both, I say in the book that we grow in connection with others. And I think as clinician, I grow in connection with my patients just as my patients grow in connection with me. And the same thing when I'm a patient in my therapy with Wendell. And I think that you can see both sides of just the shared human experience, that we're all more the same than we are different. And you can see that by what I talk about in therapy and what my patients talk about. You might not relate to the people on the surface, but I think we can all find aspects of ourselves in all of these stories. And stories are the ways that we make sense of our lives.
That's so true. For you, you talked about right at the beginning just this idea of demystifying therapy. Did you have to demystify yourself in the sense that you knew how to be a therapist, but maybe not a patient?
I think that when you're sitting on the patient side, you do all the things that patients do, even though you know better. So when I see somebody in the waiting room, when I leave, I wonder, you know, my session was a downer. I wonder if he's looking forward to her session more. Or I wondered if he liked me. And one night I Googled him because I was really curious about his life. And I know that patients Google me because they'll slip up inevitably. You know, they'll say things like, well, you know what it's like raising a middle school boy, even though I've never mention my son or his gender or his age.
What do you think that is? Why do you think people want to do that? Because there is some love of the anonymity, the idea that I don't need to have a relationship with you outside. But what do you think it is about patients who want to know more about their therapist?
I think it's hard to have this deep, intimate relationship with somebody and not know a lot about them. And I think on the one hand, we want to know, but on the other hand, we really don't. So I write in the book about a colleague of mine who she and her husband had been having fertility problems, and they were really trying hard to have a baby and had had all this heartbreak. And she was finally pregnant, and she was standing in a Starbucks when she got a call from her doctor that the pregnancy wasn't viable. And she burst into sobs in the Starbucks. And a patient happened to walk in at that moment, made eye contact with her, left, and never came back. And so I think it's almost like we want our therapist to be human, but we don't want to see their humanity.
And that is throughout the book, and that's a big part of this. Let's catch up with your story. So a practicing therapist, and you go through a breakup. You decide you want therapy. Take us from there to the moments that you met Wendell.
I met Wendell because there was an unexpected breakup, and I was sure, as my friends had assured me, that I dodged a bullet with the boyfriend. And that was my story, and I was sticking to it. And when I got to Wendell, you know, he very much didn't do what my friends did. I write in the book about the difference between idiot compassion and wise compassion. And idiot compassion is what we do with our friends. You're right. You dodged a bullet. We support them. You know, yes, your boss is a jerk. Yes, your partner did this.
You were looking for validation.
I was looking for validation because I was so sure that I was in the right. But at the same time, I think what he did, which is what therapists do, is they offer wise compassion, which is we hold up a mirror to people to help them see a reflection of themselves in a way that they can't. We all have blind spots, mm-hmm. and we all have ways that we shoot ourselves in the foot over and over and end up in the same situation. And that's what a good therapist will do. Friends tend to, you know, help you feel better in the short term, but maybe it's not so helpful in the long term.
That's so interesting, too, because you think about almost, and you talk about this not only in the book, but also in a couple articles in The Atlantic, just about this idea of who we are and how we present ourselves to the world, but also then even as we have conversations with our therapists, we're presenting ourselves. This is our take. I want to make sure you know that I was in the right.
That's right. And so when people come in, I'm listening to their story, but I'm also listening to how flexible they are with their story. What if the other people in the story were to tell their version of the story? What are we missing here? So I know that what I'm hearing is just one person's version of a story, and they're gunning for me to take a particular position. And I can say that because as the patient, I did exactly the same thing.
Yeah, I have it written down. I just looked down to say, I just have the note, unreliable narrators. That's the concept, right?
But yes.
The beauty of this book, and what I think is really attractive about it, is that you are coming into it with much more information and understanding of the relationship between therapist patients. So in a way, you're almost analytical as a patient, which is the worst thing you can be. But the idea that you're almost looking at which way he's deciding to go as a therapist and almost in a way second guessing it.
Right. I think it's hard to go into the therapy room as a therapist and not think about why they're saying what they're saying or what they're doing, and almost backseat driving, like, I don't know if I would have done it that way, or, you know, I wouldn't have said that right then. And yet what he did was very effective, so much so he was much more experienced than I was at the time. I should mention I was a newer therapist at the time that I went to him. And it was interesting because I would go straight from his office where he would say something that I thought was very important. And I would say the same thing 5 hours in a row right after that to my patients because it was so helpful for that I wanted to share it. Of course, I didn't attribute it to my therapist.
Yeah, well, that's shared experience, right? That's the idea.
Right.
It's interesting that in the book, and you talk about this a lot, that shared connection or our story as we move forward. When you first met Wendell, you weren't necessarily bowled over by him, and not exactly what you thought of a therapist.
Yeah, he seemed like he came from Therapist Central casting. He was the guy in the khakis and the loafers and the cardigan, you know, the stooped posture. But that didn't matter to me so much. It was just sort of an observation that I think we make these snap judgments about our therapists. Will they understand me? Do I have a lot in common with them? How will they understand my experience if they're different from me? And I think that kind of washes away once you get to know the person.
How long did it take you for you to recognize that you were judging him, that I'm not sure if this guy's got what it takes to be my therapist?
I think that it didn't take that long. I think that once you start talking to someone and you realize that they really do understand, and also they're calling you on your BS, that you respect them more for that. They're doing it in a gentle way, what I like to say, you know, delivering a compassionate truth bomb. But you're going for that. Otherwise, you're wasting your time. Why are you going there if someone's just going to be your yes person?
Lori Gottlieb's my guest. She's the author of Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, a therapist, her therapist, and Our Lives Revealed. She's in town. We will continue our conversation here on Extension 720 right after the break, so stay with us. Welcome back to Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. My guest, author Lori Gottlieb. She's the author of Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, a therapist, her therapist, and Our Lives Revealed. A fascinating look at therapy, but also your particular situation where you went from therapist to patient. We're just talking about it. You wrote a piece in The Atlantic just recently about your first experience as a therapist, and it's being shared widely. It's, you know, I've had several different people talking about it. This idea that it's anything goes in this room. You can prepare to be a therapist, to go through all the clinical stuff, all the master's degrees you can have, everything that you put into a chair, but you have to be ready for the curveballs.
Yeah, I think that what happens in the therapy room, it's kind of like if you're learning piano and you learn all the scales, but then what happens when you need to improvise? And you get better at it. And my very first therapy session was a little bit of a disaster, or at least I thought it was, because I was talking to this woman who was very distraught, and at a certain point, I was supposed to fill out an intake form, and I was getting none of the information that I needed, and I worried that I was going to get fired from my job on the first day. And then I look at the clock, and it's only 10 minutes after the hour. And I think, well, surely we've been in here for more than 10 minutes. And then a few minutes later, I look again, and it's 10 minutes after the hour. And I realize that the batteries are out in the clock, and I don't know what I'm supposed to do. Should I just say our time is up randomly? Have I gone over because I know I have my second new patient waiting for me
in the
waiting room?
These are things they don't teach you in the classroom.
They don't. And I think that, you know, you learn a lot from these experiences. You learn so much too. I think one of the things I always tried to do early on as a therapist was I thought that insight was so important. So we now say insight is the booby prize of therapy, meaning that you can have all the insight in the world, but if you don't make change out in the world, then the insight is useless. If you have a problem in your marriage and you know why you do what you do, but you go home and you do exactly the same thing
over and over and over, right?
What's the point of the insight?
I wrote all these things down because they're things I've been in therapy and I never knew what to call them. But at least I had an understanding, reading your book, have an understanding of things like the presenting problem, or like I mentioned, unreliable narrators or patterns and struggles and all these things that are mentioned. Why don't we start with presenting problem? That's what gets you in the room.
Yeah, the presenting problem is the reason you came. And usually the reason you came is a sign of something deeper, a struggle or pattern that got you into that situation in the first place. And so I'm listening not just to what the presenting problem is. I like to say that I'm listening to the music under the lyrics. Mm. If the lyrics are, I came here because of a breakup, what is the music under that? What is the pattern or struggle that got you into that situation?
And then identifying that as the stories continue to tell, that's an unreliable narrative. But the idea of the patterns and struggles will present themselves to you as the patient continues to come back and come back.
Yeah, they will. And I think that that's what's going to be most helpful for the patient is seeing not just what happened in this one situation, but how you can figure out why this happened so that it doesn't happen in the future.
Your situation is you went in for a breakup and you talked to Wendell. And there was something right off the bat where he was kind of grabbing your attention with this idea, this notion that maybe you weren't here necessarily for the breakup, but you're worried about something else. And that grabbed your attention quickly.
It did. He said that I made this comment that I said, well, now half my life is over. And he just glommed onto that. And I really didn't want to go there. But he was saying, you know, I think you might be grieving something bigger than the breakup. And I thought, well, what is he smoking? But he was right. And, you know, it turned out there were a lot of things that I wasn't telling him, not because I was being secretive, but because I think there are all kinds of secrets that we keep and that people keep from me in the therapy room. There are the secrets that we keep from the world and the secrets we keep from people close to us. But there are also the secrets we keep from our therapist and the secrets we keep from ourselves. And there were a lot of secrets that I was keeping from myself that then once I was more aware of them, I was keeping from him because there's so much shame. I think that we want our therapist to like and respect us. And we feel so much shame around the truth of our lives.
And in your case, you know, as you talk about the presenting problem, it's really about the journey and where you move from that. You having all of this information and knowing this, that's the connection to this book, is that even as someone who knows all of the steps that go into this, you're having these epiphanies, this idea that maybe he's right, or I wasn't thinking this way. He really did change the way you were looking at your own life.
He really did. And he did it in a way that I hadn't done in the therapy room as a clinician, which really helped me to grow as a clinician. He really brought his whole personality into the room. You know, he was a little unconventional. He was very boundaried. He never disclosed anything about his personal life, but he was very open about what he was thinking or feeling in the moment. And he would even bring in cartoons. He brought in this great cartoon of, it was a therapist who, I mean, sorry, it wasn't a therapist. It was a prisoner who was shaking the bars in a prison. And to his right and his left, the bars were open. And he was just trying to say that sometimes we feel trapped, but yet the solution, the way out is right there. We just aren't looking at it. And we feel trapped by our childhoods or our past or our fears or our circumstances. And yet the sides are open. Why don't we want to walk out?
Yeah. There's another anecdotal story about when you were complaining about suffering. And he got up from his chair. I'll let you tell the anecdote, but very unconventional. But
he did. I was going on and on about, you know, these ideas that I had about my boyfriend had moved on, and I was making this all up based on whatever I saw on social media. And he just came over and he very lightly kicked me, and then he smiled, and then he went and sat back down. And I was like, what did you just do? And he said, well, there's a difference between pain and suffering. We all experience pain, but you don't have to suffer so much. Mm. And sometimes we think other people are the cause of our suffering, but sometimes we are the cause of our suffering. So it's very human to experience pain, but sometimes we don't have to participate in our suffering so much.
Yeah, and the quote that also was not long after in the book was the idea that the truth does not change according to our possibility to stomach it. That's a great way to look at therapy, is that a lot of it is when we're ready to see what the truth is, right? The idea that we're blinded to it, and then when it's there, it's there. But a lot of times we're just uncomfortable by what the truth might be.
That's right. And I think when people come to therapy, there's a certain readiness to see the truth. I always ask when they come, not just why are you here, but why now? Why this week, this month, this year did you pick up the phone, even though this problem might have been going on for longer? I'm scanning for strengths as much as I'm looking for what's not working. And one strength is, how ready are they to hear something? How ready are they to then take that knowledge and change?
This experience is one that ends in there's an arc in the book to it, but it stays with you because you wrote it down. And you're sharing it, and we're talking about it. You're on the tour talking about this experience. Does that make it more accessible to you, the fact that it'll always be there because you made it something?
I wanted to make it something because I wanted people to start having conversations about what's going on internally with them. I think that we value emotional health so differently from the way we value physical health. So if you're having, you know, chest pains, you're probably going to go get that checked out by a cardiologist before you have a massive coronary. But if you are experiencing something feels off emotionally, or you're experiencing emotional pain, often people don't come to therapy until they're having the equivalent of an emotional heart attack. And I feel like it's harder to treat when they come in at that point. And they've also suffered unnecessarily for a long time when they could have come earlier. So I really want people to see themselves in these stories, in my story and in the other patients' stories, and to find something, like a lot of people are saying, oh, I'm like that, or I know someone mm-hmm. who's like that. And it makes them feel less isolated in their circumstances and potentially more able to reach out.
There's something you mentioned, insight, you know, this idea, but a lot of times people think that they're going to get a light's going to go off, a light bulb's going to go off, and they're going to fix all their problems. And they got their three sessions in and they feel good about the world. And that's what they expect. Or maybe that's their expectations of what therapy is. But it really is a journey. And it's not necessarily something that, like a heart attack, that you go ahead and, you know, open up an artery and everything's going to be okay.
I think that's true. But I also think that people have this misconception that you're going to go to therapy and end up there for years. And that's not the case. It can be, but that's up to you. But I think for most people, whatever they're coming in for, usually they can make a lot of improvement in a certain amount of time. That doesn't mean they're going to be there for the rest of their lives. And it's not like you're going to sit there and talk about your childhood the whole time right. either. I think we talk about our childhoods as a way to understand why we are the way we are in the present.
Patterns,
and then we
right.
can write a new chapter for the future.
I love it. Lori Gottlieb's here. She's the author of Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, a therapist, her therapist, and our lives revealed. She's my guest here in Extension 720. We'll take a break. We'll get the news. We'll come back and we'll continue the conversation with Lori here on Extension 720. Stay with us. Welcome back to Extension 720. I'm Justin Kaufman here on 720 WGN. Lori Gottlieb's my guest. She's the author of Maybe You Should Talk to Someone. She does the Dear Therapist a column at The Atlantic. She's also a New York Times bestselling author. Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, a therapist, her therapist, and Our Lives Revealed, talking about her story of being a therapist and then a patient. And back to a therapist and a patient. There's a great scene in the book right at the end that really, you say at some point towards the end, you talk about what the search is for. And a lot of times people assume therapy is a search for happiness. But you in this book, and it pulls out that really it's a search for meaning. Explain.
Yeah. So people who search for happiness are kind of setting themselves up for disappointment, because we find happiness mediated through meaning and purpose and connection. And one of the main themes of this book is that we grow in connection with others. And I think that a lot of people are unhappy because they don't have enough connection in their mm-hmm. lives. No matter what people come in for, they talk about there's sort of an underlying loneliness, even if they're surrounded by people. And we're so often, you know, with our screens. I think the therapy room is one of the few places where you can sit face to face with another person for 50 minutes straight, hear them breathe, look into their eyes, and not have something pinging or vibrating or dinging, or the phones on the table at the restaurant or the screens on the walls, and really listen to each other and hear. But so many people don't do that. Yeah. And so I think that they're searching for some idea of happiness that doesn't really exist. We do feel happy when we have meaning and purpose and connection in our lives. But how to help people to find that is part of what therapy is about.
It seems like every 6 months or so, you get a thought piece, maybe in The Atlantic or other places, talking about the loneliness epidemic. And you'll see articles and professors and academics talk about loneliness. Is that, in your estimation, is that where we're at? Are we in it? We have an epidemic of loneliness, and it's causing us to have constant search for something that we don't necessarily know?
There is so much loneliness out there. And I think it has to do, too, with this idea of instant gratification, that it's hard to get to know somebody because we don't spend the time getting to know them. We're texting people instead of going to have coffee with them. We don't take the time to meet new people. We don't have organic ways of connecting with people in the neighborhood, or through organizations the way that maybe we used to. So I think a lot of people are having a relationship with their phone, but they're not really having the kinds of relationships that nurture them. You can see when people come in the therapy room, when you're face-to-face with someone, your heart rate goes down, you breathe more easily. Physiologically, it changes you.
You had mentioned in the article as well, the one about your first experience, this idea of Googling. And you kind of mentioned it too, just because there's the idea of Googling therapists, and that's one thing. But then there's also this idea of the picture that we present ourselves, and whether it be on social media, on Facebook or Twitter or whatever, but who we are there as opposed to who we are for real. And you see the difference because you'll be in the room with patients. And this is something that you can constantly tell people. We constantly say that what's actually projected on social media may not be the same thing. Yet we still have these feelings around watching someone else be happy or feeling like that projection is better than me or better than the people around me.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that the reason that we don't Google our patients, well, there are many reasons, but one of the reasons is that the story that they put out there is very different from the story that they're going to tell us. And we really want to hear in their words what they tell us, when they say it, how they present it. That will give us information about them. But I think that a lot of people, even though they know intellectually that Facebook and Instagram are not reality, mm-hmm. I think that it causes a lot of this feeling of missing out, this feeling of alienation, that something must be wrong with my life because I'm not in Hawaii with my family on the beach and we all look beautiful. That's one moment, and it might even be a curated moment.
And it feels like, once again, it kind of falls into what you were just saying about this search for meaning as opposed to a search for happiness. There seems like we're projecting happiness, and then we're chasing happiness, but nobody is actually thinking about how to get to happiness.
You know, my colleague has this theory that she said that when people who are married put, you know, all these, like, all of a sudden they do a burst of these, like, wonderful romantic posts on Facebook. She says 3 months later, you're going to get their splitting up announcement. Now, she was saying that in jest, but I think there's some truth to that why do we need to tell everybody something? If we're really feeling that, if we're really happy about something, why do we need to post that so publicly?
From your profession, too, I wonder how much social media was born of wanting connection. I mean, the reason that it's so popular, the reason that it took off and became a cottage industry, people are taking advantage of the fact that we want to project happiness or we want to search for something. Yeah. There's a reason we use it.
We do, but I think there are some good things about technology. So I'm not anti-technology and I'm not anti-social media. Yeah. But, you know, when I see, for example, in the book, there's this young woman, Charlotte, in her 20s, and she's having trouble. You know, she's hooking up with the wrong guys. And at one point, she's got her thumbs in the air and she's saying, and then he said with her thumbs. And then she said with her thumbs. And I'm like, wait, you had that conversation on text? And she said, yes. And I tried to explain to her that you can't really look into somebody's eyes or see their body language. And she said, without a trace of irony, oh, but we also use emojis. And it's a generational thing. It made me feel very old. But it's a generational thing where people are having relationships mediated through their phones, too. And these are really important conversations that you need to learn to have with somebody so that you can have a real relationship with them.
Is the industry, therapy and just psychotherapy in general, will it have to evolve because of the new ways that generations interact with each other, communicate with each other, the wants and feelings and all the kind of things that happen with a new generation of people because of technology and other things that are happening? Or is it as old as time, meaning that those things are in the way of what we know from our human existence?
I think what we know from our human existence is that we all want to love and be loved. And we all seek that on some deep level. And that's the common denominator amongst people is what do they want? They want to love and be loved. And sometimes technology and the pace of our lives and the way we live our lives and some of these, again, the search for happiness, all of those things get in the way. And I think people need to really focus on what their core needs are and how to get those.
Back to the book, and we'll finish here. You changed the names. You changed the situation, so we don't know. Even to Wendell, who's the main character, is the therapist that you work with. Have they approached you at all about how they feel about being in the book? Or did they know they're in, like, have you changed it enough where they're like, that's not me? Or have you gotten any feedback from them?
Yeah. So I first of all, I only wrote about people that I'm no longer seeing because I didn't think that I could work with people and write about them without it somehow impacting the work.
Right.
And I didn't want.
And
to
from
respect.
The patient side, there's a little bit of fear of like, I hope that they're helping me, but at the same time, I hope they're not retaining this for future use.
I think it would be hard to not have that in the back of their minds or my mind.
Right.
Either. And yes, I got permission and I changed everything. So, you know, and I think anybody who comes to me knows that I was a writer before I was a therapist. And I think they've seen how I've handled writing about patients in the past. And I do it with the utmost respect. If I'm, you know, if there's anyone who's sort of more raw and open in this book, it's me, you know, more than my patients.
Right, right. Lori Gottlieb, thank you so much for being here. And thanks for having the conversation about your new book. Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, a Therapist, Her Therapist, and Our Lives Revealed. Lori, thanks for being on Extension 720.
My pleasure.